Okay, I'll be talking. This is kind of split into two pieces. The first is a description of the Cassini project itself and how it operates and what the constraints are. And the second part is the imaging science subsystem, which is one of the instruments I'm involved with. Cassini was launched in 1997, and it arrived at Saturn in 2004, and it's been orbiting Saturn ever since. It put a probe, the Huygens probe, into the Titan atmosphere in 2005, and since then it's been just the orbiter orbiting the Saturn system. And the plan is to continue until 2017. Some issues about the spacecraft. It doesn't have a scan platform, so if you want to point somewhere, you have to turn the entire spacecraft. It's a pretty big spacecraft. It's the size of a bus, and it has something like 13 different scientific instruments, and they're all competing for pointing and time and data rate and so forth. It has reaction wheels as well as thrusters, and normally we use the reaction wheels for attitude control, but when we need to turn fast, we use thrusters, which is a pretty small part of the time of the mission. Unfortunately, we've been starting to have problems over the last few years with the reaction wheels, and they are degrading, and the project is managing them more tightly. Every year that goes by, we have new constraints. Now we're in the part of the mission called the Equinox mission, which includes the time that the Sun coincided with the equatorial plane of Saturn, and we'll soon be going into the next phase of the mission, which is called the Solstice mission. We hope to get to the solstice, which would be summer in the northern hemisphere in 2017, and at that point the mission ends. The periapses that we have are typically around 5 arsabes or greater, and the apoapses go out to 20 to 60 RS. Obviously, we spend most of the time in the apoapses segments, but most of the high-priority observations are concentrated in the periaps segments, which typically last 2 to 3 days around periaps. Titan is used for gravity assists, and so we have to have quite a few Titan encounters every 2 to 3 revs. We get a close Titan encounter for a gravity assist and also for close observations of Titan. So there's a period of about 2 days when just about the only thing we do is observe Titan when we're close. 2 days out of every time we fly by. Something about the decision-making process. The very top level thing that we have to pay attention to is called the traceability matrix, and this is like the Bible of the Cassini mission, where we have a listed set of science priorities, and everything we do now has to trace back to those science priorities. And this is becoming a bigger and bigger issue, and more formal. One of the recent added tasks that we have now is to trace every observation that's made back to this traceability matrix. NASA Mission Review Committee wanted to see that as something we're doing in the Solstice mission. So in order to carry that out, the highest level of the decision-making process is called the Project Science Group, which consists of the instrument PIs and team leaders, and the project scientist, Linda Spilker, leads that group. We also have, at a lower level, more of the details are carried out in these things called the orbital science teams, and there are two of them, one for Titan and one for icy satellites. And there are also four target working teams for Saturn, rings, magnetosphere, and one called cross-discipline, which is where instrument calibrations go and other things that don't seem to fall into the three previous groups. And those groups.
Question?
Yeah.
Apparently, the traceability matrix can be evolved with time because it's sort of what came
I don't think it's in there, so... There's an item in there that says respond to new discoveries. Maybe that could be considered an umbrella where exoplanets could go in there. There's probably a mechanism to get things linked in there that way.
Unless it can evolve with time, there's no hope at all for us.
I don't think it's going to evolve with time. I think the only thing that can evolve with time is this response to new discoveries. You want to say anything, Christoph? I wouldn't say it's impossible to get an exoplanet observation in there. I think you have to come in with something with high science priority and argue for it. Christoph has already involved in one of those. More about science planning. We have this orbital tour now, which is a description of periapsis distance, apoapsis distance, inclination of the plane, encounters with satellites and all that. This is the path of the spacecraft through the system. That tour has been defined pretty closely now for the rest of the mission. There's still a few details, especially at the end of the mission, but there isn't much left to be done there. So that's part is done. What we're working on now is deciding where to point instruments. And that activity goes on at these OST and TWIT groups, we're planning for things that are going to happen 9 months from now. So we're on a time scale that is not going to work well if you need a shorter turnaround time than that. There's a big negotiation process that goes on. All these 13 teams have different interests, and everybody's trying to get time. We split up this decision-making process into two main steps. One is the highest priority items that we need to get in a timeline, and that is those negotiations for the entire mission are almost done now. We only have about 20 or 30% of the time or of those high priority objectives that still need to be planned, but these are a relatively small fraction of the time, only about 2,000 hours of the time in the mission. Once those are decided, it's up to the target working teams and the OST to carry those out and to fill in the time with the lower priority observations. And so the way this would work is that November of 2012, it was decided that there's a rings objective that's high priority that gets into the periapsis period, and that periapsis would then be assigned to the rings working group to implement that and also add additional rings observations. So that periapsis period would go to rings with maybe one or two other science objectives that might have icy satellites or Saturn mixed in, but mostly it would be rings periapsis. And so that's the way things are getting planned at this point. More about constraints. Since we have to turn the entire spacecraft to communicate, that means that about 8 hours or 10 hours out of every 1 or 2 days, we have to turn to Earth, the antenna pointed to Earth, to downlink the data. That takes up a fair chunk of time where you can't do observations. This business about the reaction wheels I mentioned before, we're getting problems with the reaction wheels, and the engineering teams are getting conservative. They want these things to last until 2017. And so they're putting down new rules for us. And one of them that just came along recently is that we can do 2 out of 3 types of turns, depending on whether it's an optical remote sensing instrument, or whether it's a magnetospheric type of objective, or whether we're doing downlinks and calibration rolls. You can only do 2 out of the 3 in those categories. And so we have yet to see how that's going to play out, but it's a new rule for us and more restrictive. Finally, there's a funding issue here. We're in the Solstice mission starting in the next fiscal year. We're dropping to 60 for the operations part of Cassini is dropping to 60% of its 2008 levels. The scientists are actually doing better than that at 75%, but the worry then is that with only 6% funding on the operations, how are we going to do that? And I don't think we can do that entirely by gaining efficiencies. I think there's going to have to be some science given up. And I don't think the science community is coming to grips with this yet, because the timelines are continuing to fill up. So now I'm going to shift gears and talk about the ISS instrument and what it can do. There are 2 cameras, narrow and wide-angle camera. The narrow-angle camera has a focal length of 2,000 millimeters. The wide-angle camera has a shorter focal length by a factor of 10. The narrow-angle is a 7.5-inch diameter reflecting primary, and the wide-angle camera is a refractor, considerably smaller diameter, but also it's a faster system. Both cameras have CCDs. The narrow-angle camera has a slightly larger wavelength coverage, from about 200 nanometers to 1100 nanometers. The wide-angle camera doesn't go quite that far, especially in the short wavelengths. This is a sketch of the narrow-angle camera. Here's the primary mirror. This is a dual filter wheel. Both cameras have dual filter wheels, and then they both have this detector package with the CCD. And here's the wide angle camera. It has an objective lens out here in the front. Again, a dual filter wheel and a detector package. The 2 wheels allow us to match filters like was done with the WIFPIC 2 camera. That's useful. I think for this group, though, probably most people would just be interested in the clear filters that let through the full bandpass. The exposure ranges we have are from 5 milliseconds to 1,200 seconds. However, as I mentioned earlier, once you get beyond 48 seconds exposure in the narrow-angle camera, you begin to smear. In the wide-angle camera, the pixels are 10 times larger in angular extent, so you can go a lot longer before smearing. We have 4 gain states, from 12 electrons to 233 electrons per dN. The detector is held at a fairly constant minus 90 C. And at that temperature, there is residual bulk image that comes out of the detector over timescales of several tens to several hundreds of seconds, and this is a big issue for it. It turns out it's the biggest contributor to our dark fields. I'll talk about that a little bit more later. And that leads right into the next bullet here. Because we have this residual bulk image issue, the camera is initialized before every exposure by a light flood. That saturates the detectors by a factor of 300 over saturation or something. And whatever residual image was there before gets, then the frame is read out immediately before the shutter opens. That initializes the state of the CCD to something that's the same every time. But we still have to deal with this residual bulk image from the light flood. We have 12-bit encoding, but we have a square root compressor to go to 8 bits if we want to, not necessary. We also have lossless, lossy compression are available and as choices. To quickly go through the calibration procedure, these are the things that have to be done. If we use the 12:8 conversion, we have to reverse that. We have to subtract bias, and we subtract the bias from overclock pixels. We have a signal imposed called, we call it a 2 hertz signal because that's approximately the frequency. It's a quasi-sinusoidal signal that's imposed probably near the amplifier after as the CCD is read out. There seems to be some voltage that's superimposed on that. We have to take that out. We have to subtract the dark field, which is mostly this residual bulk image from the light flood. There are very small nonlinear terms that we apply. We apply a flat field, and we have individual filter corrections to get the absolute calibration as best we can. And finally, we can convert the dN to intensity, or I over F, where F is the solar flux. Here's an example of an image of Vega. Vega is right in here. And in this stretch, I'm bringing up the low dN value so that you can see this horizontal pattern. That's the 2 hertz noise I was talking about that's superimposed on all images, but it's phasing changes. It's not constant, so we can't use one image to calibrate another image. It has to be from scratch every time. And you can see some cosmic rays hits, which are common to all these kinds of instruments and make it a little harder to do the photometry. Here's a plot, a line plot of that previous image, and you can see the levels that we're talking about. These little wiggles are the 2 hertz signal, and this is the overall bias plus dark signal from the light flood. And we believe we can calibrate these features pretty well and remove them pretty well down to the 1 dN level. So I don't think that's a serious issue for the photometry, but we have other serious issues for the photometry which are not identified. And to give you a sense of how good we can do, this is our absolute calibration on Vega. Both the NAC and WAC cameras are plotted here. And I'd say the fit is pretty good, but you can see the spread. I mean, we're not talking about millimags here. We're talking about a few percent is as good as we can do. To give people a sense of the sensitivity, if anyone wants to go off and calculate how long an exposure you need for your favorite object, I've listed some things here. With the WAC, one example is a magnitude 4.8 G star that we exposed for 100 milliseconds, and it gave 1500 dNs. The maximum is 4096 for 12 bits. And when we integrate the signal, we get 7100 dNs, which at this gain state corresponds to 210,000 electrons. For Vega, which is quite bright, magnitude zero essentially, we integrated for 15 milliseconds with the WAC and got about the same number of electrons. This is, again, to give more sense of how well we can do with the photometry. This is now a plot of our calibrations on three different sources, actually more than three. There are a number of UV bright stars that we use for calibrators in addition to Vega and Saturn's moon Enceladus. And you can see the spread here is on the order of a few percent. And it's similarly for the wide angle camera. Here it's a little bit worse in some wavelengths. Here's an example of one thing we tried to do, which was to assess the charge transfer efficiency using stars in a star cluster. And the method was to image the star cluster where we had quite a few stars. In this case, we used 30-some stars in the example. Then we rotated the entire spacecraft by 20 or 30 degrees and re-imaged. And then we did that again. And then we had, as a result of that, we had a number of images where the star moved around on the image, and we could make a plot as a function of line number what the star flux was. And if the charge transfer efficiency is sufficiently low, that we could plot the slope of line number versus flux, we could get this charge transfer efficiency. And so we did that for all these stars, and that came out like this. And what we're looking for is a signal that's not very different from one, maybe 0.999 or something like that. And you can see here that the scatter is, in these measurements, is too large for us to be able to do that. And that's just another sense, to give you a sense of what we can do. And I don't know why it's that large. It's much larger than I would have expected from square root of number of electrons dominating the noise. And so if anybody has ideas of how to figure this out, I'd be interested. Now, moving on to flat fields. I think our flat fields are pretty good. Here's an image of Titan surface, and it's a little hard to see here, but there are these dust rings. And what we've done in flight calibration is we've occasionally looked at images of Titan. Titan's very bland, and so just about everything you see is an artifact. And these dust specks cause these rings, and here we're showing as a function of epoch where these rings first appear. So the red ones appeared early in the mission before we ever got to Titan, and they're still there. And then we started seeing more of them. Here's one that occurred shortly after Titan first encounter, and then later we saw this one, and then later this one, and so forth. And so we have a whole list of different epochs corresponding to the identification of new dust rings. And at this point, this is, I think, the best we can do in terms of identifying changes in the flat field. The amplitude of these things are not very big. I'd say these darkest corners here are maybe 5% darker than the average value. But we think we can do a good job with the flat field. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about the point spread function. This is a plot for the wide angle camera. It's pretty similar for the narrow angle camera. And this is diffraction limit for the optics. But the measured point PSF, once you get a couple of tens of pixels or maybe not even that much away from the center, the measured PSF is quite large relative to the diffraction limit. I believe that's due to internal reflections in the system. And that's also related to the stray light situation. Here are two examples. In this case, there's a bright object up here, which was Saturn probably. And we're picking up a kind of a caustic pattern here, which is lined up with the diffraction pattern of the spikes for the secondary mirror holder. In this case, Saturn is up here. And again, you can see the brightest part of the stray light is coming down this way. And I don't know if you can see it because we need a little darker room in here, but there's a pattern in here as well. This is just two examples, and I could show you other examples that are very different, where the patterns are quite different than they are here. So this is an area that when we're close to a bright object, especially with a wide-angle camera, we get a lot of stray light, and it can be a big problem. And this is a graph that shows, in kind of in an average sense, how the stray light depends on angle. These were observations taken relative to the sun, and so we have good signal to noise. The wide-angle camera is not baffled, and it has a pretty serious stray light issue. This is in terms of I over F, which means even though we're looking at dark space, if we are up here, it would be the same brightness as a Lambert reflector with a reflectivity at this level is 0.1. So it's a pretty big signal. The narrow angle camera is a lot better. So I'll end that here, and these are some references which describe the cameras. One of them is published, and one of them is in manuscript form to be published soon, or to be in press soon, I believe. Okay.
So maybe I misunderstood what you did, but how do you get a CT of greater than one?
This is a measurement, and what it really is delta flux over delta line number. And what's wrong here is that the measurement isn't as good as it needs to be. I mean, it needs to be, I mean, the measurement, according to the measurement, we had more flux when the image traversed a greater number of lines and traversed a shorter, less number of lines. And so I don't believe that's telling us CTE, that's just measurement error.
I had a question about your image. Your PSF covers how many, or the half max covers how many pixels?
Full width half max is typically 1.4 to 1.7 pixels for most filter combinations.
Okay, well, I think then you would expect to have these photometric effects having to do with, you know, the location of the sensor.
Micro sensitivity on the pixels you're talking about. Yeah, that's probably what it is.
Yeah, so, you know, if you get a lot of photometry with, you know, different locations of point sources, you can sort of map out what that is. That's what they've done with HST, and it improves the photometry from, you know, a few percent.
Yeah, maybe we could do better, I mean, if we worked hard doing something like that, but I'd have to see if that would work.
Other question?
A non-science question. You said that the budget was being reduced to 60% or something like that for
of
planning.
2008 levels, right?
What does that mean in terms of, you know, the operations? Does it mean
that
if we add experiments that they can't be done, or I mean, does it have an impact?
Yeah,
what we might think about?
It has an impact. I think the impact is in two ways. One, we have to find more efficient ways of doing things, and we can find some of those efficiencies because we've been in this mission for a number of years now. And so teams say that they can find new efficiencies, but I think it also means we have to do less. And I think the science team hasn't caught up with that, doing less yet, because we're filling up the timeline even still.
Does doing less mean, like, you turn off the spacecraft for, you know, every second day or something? You know, you take furloughs every Friday or what?
In terms of science, I think it means taking furloughs. In terms of, you don't turn off the spacecraft, but you just sit there and not do anything. But as I say, the scientists haven't caught up with that yet, and we're still completely subscribing the timeline. And we haven't seen yet how this is going to work, because the new workforce level is going to go into effect in late September, I think, the start of the new fiscal year. And that's when we'll see whether these plans we're making are going to fall apart.
Okay, just one last question.
I'd actually comment on that point. It seems to me that actually the implication of this for us is that if we want to get a bunch of very friendly collaborators from Cassini, we should find a way to get some operations support. Yeah, so. Well, I mean, to get to support operations, and if we get that funding, then then allow the people to hire.
The science goes where the funding is. Yeah. I just had one quick question. You said that the reaction wheels were decaying, and are you projecting that these are going to last all the way out through 2017?
Well, the projection is for them to last, but that might be wishful thinking. I mean, the plan
That's
is for them
asking.
To last. Yeah. And the backup plan, if they don't last, I mean, there is a spare. So if one fails, then they can bring in the spare. We haven't had a failure yet. We're just having glitches. So, I mean, one scenario might be that we get a failure 2 years down the line, we bring in the other reaction wheel, and either it lasts or it doesn't last. If it doesn't last, then we're on hydrazine as long as hydrazine lasts. And I think If that happens, we'd have a revision, a reevaluation of what we're doing, depending on how much more of the mission has to be done, because obviously the hydrazine isn't going to last very long, and we'd probably want to say, well, what are our very highest priority observations that we have to do, that we can do on hydrazine?
So my understanding is that one of the ways that Spitzer saved money when they went to the warm Spitzer is by going, basically just increasing the length of the typical observing proposals. So they just allowed, they in fact encouraged people to submit these obscenely long observing proposals, because it's a lot cheaper to just stare at some object for a really long amount of time than to have lots of different proposals. And so it seems, in a similar way, I mean, it seems you guys could do a similar thing, which might be useful. I know with Warm Spitzer, that turned out to be great for exoplanet people, because we often want to just stare at something for 5 days straight if we can.
There's some of that. The trouble is that there are too many fingers in the pie, and the competition just doesn't seem to decrease. So we're just struggling with it. But I think in terms of how to get involved with Cassini, your best bet is to make contact with the imaging team, if the imaging instrument is the right one. Talk to Carolyn Porco, who's the team leader, and say, this is what we want to do. Here's what it would take. And she'll say, probably, okay, let's make sure the science priority is well described, because I still think it's the case that if you have a high science priority, it'll be considered. But even so, there's not very much resource to take advantage of. So if it's something you can do with a few observations that don't take a lot of time, don't interfere with what other people are doing already, I'd say there's a good chance that you'll get it in. So that's your best bet, I would think.
Well, it would actually seem to me that most of the observations we would want probably wouldn't interfere very much, because we probably want to do our observations when we're as far from Saturn as possible, which is when you guys don't want to do the observations, is it?
Those
are full.
That time's full up too, but
okay.
All you can do is make your case and see what happens.
Yeah. We'll get some money to bring them.
I don't even know if that's going to be helpful. I mean, the tension there is that the project has spent a lot of effort now with NASA headquarters describing how they're going to do the Solstice mission out to 2817, and how they're going to do it on a reduced budget, and how they're going to fulfill their traceability matrix things. And I think Bob Mitchell, who's the project, the leader of the project, is kind of nervous if somebody comes in and say now we're going to have some new objectives and we need new money from NASA. I think he might see that as a little bit of undercutting his credibility and having built up his case and justified it to NASA. So that might be a little tricky.
Astrophysics has funded some experiment at Cassini. Are those under this team here? We funded about a year and a half ago Henry Todd from Georgia State to take images, and he proposed to us, because there was an open call on astrophysics, to do Cassini astrophysics, and he proposed to do parallaxes at 10AU, so.
I don't know a thing about that. I haven't even heard of that observation.
He got the observation this summer, and he was working with a graduate student on that, and I haven't seeing the result, but he was quite excited to do that. Very clever. In fact, Cassini can take any field, and then you mimic the field from the ground, whether it's north or the south, right? So you just take a Cassini field, and then go and match it from the ground, and then you do your algorithm to calculate distances. So had never been done at 10AU or so, which is a huge advantage.
Okay, I think that's a good example of what I was mentioning before. You make a good case, this is good science, you go to...
No, but we paid for that, astrophysics paid for that a particular investigation. I don't know if there was any money paid to the actual team to run the hour or 2 hour or whatever time he used, but at least we paid the researcher for the grant.
Yeah, that's fine.